Catch up on all the live shows right here on africatechradio.com.
Hi, you're welcome to Back to Base on Africa Tech Radio, and my name is Lillian. Back to Base is a program where we talk to tech founders to say how their brain works so that you can know that you don't have to be so much to achieve so much. You can start from wherever you are to get to where you want to get to. I don't want to talk too much because I have someone here. We have spoken to her a couple of times, but I've not spoken to her in this capacity. And I have been really curious. Anytime I see her out there, I'll think, where did she start? How did she even think to go into this field? And how has the journey been? And that's what she's here to tell us about. I'm talking about Blessing Abeng. She's a powerhouse in the African tech scene. She's a branding and communications expert who has helped numerous businesses tell their stories and build their brands. Beyond that, she advocates for, you know, youths. She empowers African youths. Her journey includes co-founding Disha. In fact, she's going to tell us all of this. I don't want to spoil it. Okay. Hello, Blessing.
Hi.
Let's just go straight to it, right? I'd like to know about how founders started. It helps me and others to know that, you know, founders are human beings, people who are making their name in the industry. They are humans and they started somewhere. It will motivate those coming behind us to reach for their goals. So now we're just going to start with you and your background. Is there anything in your background that sets you up for what you're doing today?
To be honest, I would say nothing and everything. Nothing in the sense that at the time when I was experiencing it and living that particular reality, it didn't feel like that's what I was heading towards. Because anyone who knows my story, or if you even Google me, one of the things you'll find out is I wanted to be a doctor when I was starting out, right? I thought, you know, I want to save lives. And the only expression of saving lives at the time that I was aware of was medical doctor. I wanted to be a neurosurgeon because that was also not popular. All the little things that I was doing, all the different ways that I was expressing myself, my talent, you know, I see now, looking back, how they all added up to bringing me to this particular point, to this point where I feel like there isn't one way to save lives. There are multiple expressions saving lives. People who are farming and cooking and, you know, pharmacists, or everyone who is doing something that is honest and useful and empowering somebody is just making the world a little bit better. And in one way or the other, we're saving lives. So coming back to the question you asked, my dad was a disaster. My mom was an accountant who worked in the civil building. Very early on, we were put in scenarios where we had to pitch things. And it was interesting to see to pitch sometimes when we're not even trying. It was interesting to experiment. I worked with my dad as a secretary while I was in secondary school because I was trying to really learn about business. He made me read books that I naturally wouldn't have read, or I don't even think my mates would have been reading at the time. Towards business. There's so many dynamic things that I feel like I was doing. I was representing my school. When I was a day student in a school that was a mixed school, I would buy contraband. Oh my God, I hope I'm not caught for this, but I would buy contraband and sell it at a higher price and I would make profit. They paid me convenience fee, right? So these were tiny enterprising things that I was doing, but I didn't necessarily know that I was going to become a founder. Even when I got into university, I wrote a whole book, registered a whole business because I wanted to self-publish my book. And then I ended up self-publishing that book, made my first million. You know, it wasn't something I planned. I said, oh, I want to make my first million. It was just me showing up, doing things that I wanted to do per time. But now I'm seeing how all of those things have added up and become relevant experience in my current life.
Oh, wonderful. I'm curious, when you say you started pitching, you learned how to pitch as a kid, can you paint that scenario for me?
To be honest, if you want something, you have to. And I think everybody, sort of, we were all in this situation. I don't know about you. But if you needed something from your parents, you would have to make a case for that thing that you want, right? And in making a case for it, you have to give pros and cons. You have to explain why that thing was important, why they should do that versus do something else that was more useful to your life. why should they give you that money that they give you during Christmas, that all those mint notes they give you during Christmas? What is it that you want to use that money for that is more useful than the education that they're providing for you, or for, that the food that you realize, you get, like, you know, all of those little things. You had to make a case for the things that you wanted. My dad and my mom raised my sister and I to be very outspoken, to defend and ask for the things that we want. So I think in some ways that made us a bit articulate when we would ask for things. And we were met with a lot of rejections. Of course, we got no's a lot. But I think if you really look back, those things unconsciously may have prepared me for the amount of rejections I would also receive as a founder. Because if you heard no as a child over and over and over again, and then in the situations where you now finally hear yes, you can see, you know, okay, these were the things you did right, these were the cases that you made, these were the things that made sense. Then you start to develop skill to help you, you know, advocate for those things better. I was also in debate club. I represented my school. There were so many interesting things I did growing up, to be honest. I advocated for my classmates, to our teachers. And I'm going all the way to mundane things like that because we don't really hold them with value. We think that most of the learnings that we learn are in our adult life. But not necessarily. Sometimes they go that far back.
Hmm. You and I had very different childhood, but that's fine. So you have interest in branding and communications, right? What initially sparked your interest in that field?
Okay, so you remember how I said I wanted to be a medical doctor?
Mm-hmm.
I had gone on to Covenant University to study biochemistry, which was literally seen as a pre-medical course. And during my IT days, I had to work in a virology institute and then work in a HIV research center where we were focused on, you know, we would take the viral loads of HIV patients and just sort of check that viral load to inform them whether, you know, their viral load was high or low and how, like, if they were safe, if they needed more antiretroviral drugs, if they were closer to having AIDS, things like that. During that period, even if I was very prepared to save lives, I don't think I ever really confronted the reality of the lives that I would lose. So as a surgeon, you're going to lose some lives. As a doctor, there's some people that are going to die. In the spirit of saving lives, for the lives that you lose as well, how do you tell those family members that, oh, sorry, I couldn't save your loved one? You know, that was not something I wanted to deal with. Also felt like a long time before I was going to become a surgeon, not to think of a neurosurgeon. And I started to explore, you know, are there other ways that we can save lives? Like, it can't just be one way. And I took interest in business at the time. I got back to school. I joined a club. And during my period in that club, we were asked to put together a business plan. I did a lot of research. I learned how to write a business plan. What was interesting was that the way that I wrote business plans, people loved it so much that they started to pay for it. And they would say that the marketing side of my business plans were phenomenal. A lot of people would pay me money to write business plans for them in university. And that just transcended into a friend of mine saying, Destin, this thing you do where you can combine very strategic thinking and very creative thinking together, that's literally on your way towards branding. So it piqued my interest and I started to research more about branding. I found that it was something that I found very interesting. And I went ahead to enroll in the School of Branding and ended up, you know, working in a small business, moving on to working in an agency. And then just over and over again, I kept building capacity that led me eventually towards like having a solid career in branding and communications. So that was really my path. And somehow that led me to co-founding a company and becoming the CMO of a tech company that eventually got acquired by FirstRA, and then becoming director of communications for a nonprofit where we train people with about 130,000 people with tech skills and a community of over 250,000.
So you're talking about Disha, right? Did I pronounce it well?
Yes, you did.
Okay. All right. So from Disha, did you eventually solve the problems that you wanted to solve, or did you have to go forward to solve it?
I think we all did. I think everybody who was on the team, we did the best that we could with the resources that we had, and we truly solved the problems that we wanted to what was even really cool was that a lot of things that were supposed to be our very future goals ended up becoming things that were achieved so much faster just because of that acquisition as well. That was interesting to watch, and I think I put those use.
Okay. So after Disha, you went on to co-found Ingressive for Good. You've told me why you did Disha. Why did you look into Ingressive for Good?
Okay, so right before Disha, I was building a community with my partner where we were connecting, educating and empowering entrepreneurs. And we ended up building a community of about 10,000 people, 10,000 entrepreneurs. During that period where we were doing that, we had the moments where we would bring people to speak, right? People who were accomplished within the entrepreneurship space or people who were also building for the African tech ecosystem. And that was where I think I met the person who had the idea for Ingressive for Good, which was Maya. She was really interested at the time in bringing me to become a VC, like to work in her VC company and, you know, help with marketing. And that was something I was very interested in. However, when she spoke to me about her idea, because as a VC, she was saying that, yes, a lot of people think that they need money. But when you give them that money, the next thing you begin to realize is that they're looking for talent. Talent is really what they need to build it to the next level. So she wanted to build that ecosystem where, or she wanted to contribute to the ecosystem by helping to build talent and capacity for the African tech entrepreneurs that were building at the time. But on top of that, there was also a reality when we did a lot of research to find out that a lot of Nigerians were not just living under $1. Per day, but they wanted to live better lives, right? And they were willing to do legal things, very legal things, to build that capacity. However, they didn't have access. And so when we realized that, and we realized that the space for you to learn a tech skill, especially the basic ones, 3 months to 6 months, right? You can literally learn the basics of a tech skill, and all you have to do is practice after that. What can we do to combine all of these findings together and make this into something sustainable that can contribute our quota to the African tech ecosystem and actually the whole, to the African youth in general? And that's how we founded Ingressive for Good. I was one of the people on the co-founding team until I became a co-founder. We worked really relentlessly on that project. What then happened was we ended up building from zero all the way to thousands and hundreds of thousands as well. So that was something that's a project that I'm really proud of. I'm really happy that we were able to bring access to the doorsteps of African youth who otherwise, you know, could probably not have had those access. And what I mean by that is, it's not that people don't want to train. They don't have the money to pay for these really expensive courses. And the courses are generally available. You don't know how to train yourself to know which one to learn first. But we had the capacity to partner with people like Coursera, Meta, DataCamp, Masterclass, all of these people to bring opportunities to the doorsteps of the youth, and they didn't have to pay a dime for it. So that was really powerful, and that was an impactful project.
Well, so far you've grown your community to over 250,000, and you've trained over 100,000.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible feat. You should celebrate often. What? Can you share some of the strategies that you have used to achieve this kind of growth? Because a lot of people have this idea, right? They have this idea down, but growing is a problem. They are stagnant. So can you share some of the strategies you've used to achieve your growth?
Okay, some of the core things that we did were partnerships. I think partnerships was such an instrument, our collaboration. Collaboration was such an instrumental part of our growth process. We didn't try to do everything alone. We didn't try to reinvent the wheel. There are people who were already doing stuff to a certain extent, but then they needed help. So, for example, some people have courses, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't know how to get people to take those courses in a very systematic way or get them to complete those courses. And we had the power of community. So that was another thing that we did. We engaged people as people, and then brought them into a space that was a truly thriving community. So community for us was not all email list. It wasn't WhatsApp message. It wasn't followers on social media. It was a group of actual people that we would bring into particular spaces, and we would get them to interact with each other, right? And the reason why that was really powerful was that sometimes I might be in a low, like I might be just starting and I might encounter specific issues that I don't even know how to explain. But instead of asking somebody I think is way beyond me, I might feel more comfortable asking my peer that I feel like we're on the same level. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that was such a helpful way to building that community and interacting with the community. Some of the things that we did while building the community was ensuring, one, we didn't talk to them as though they weren't good enough or they weren't enough or they weren't great people. We spoke to them from a place of respect, honor, and as people that we understood. So we spoke to them in languages that they understood. One other rule that we had as a nonprofit was we were never going to indulge in poverty porn, right? So we would not belittle people and put them in scenarios where they look like, you know, the world is ending, Africans are poor, come and help us type of thing. No, instead, we would promote the good that they were doing. We would show you that they had the capacity. We would say, this is where they were. This is what they did. This is where they are now. We made a habit of sharing transformation stories as opposed to poverty stories. And so that was really strong as well, where we were always empowering people and showing that empowerment journey as opposed to just showing them in the mud or when they are still down and, you know, all of that. So we never did that. One last thing that I can share that we did as well, we're not afraid to ask for help. And we knew how to negotiate and ask for things, even if they weren't exactly what we wanted. And what I mean by that is, one of the times that we spoke to one of our partners, and we reached there thinking, oh, we would ask for a percentage discount so we can afford their platform. We couldn't afford the platform at all, even at a percentage discount. So instead of us saying, oh, sorry, okay, bye-bye, good night, this is way too expensive, see you next time, what we instead did was we asked, do you have a CSR program that you are working on? Because we have the capacity to run a CSR program. Do you get? These are the things we know how to do. These are the things we've done. This is how we can get it done. They listened to us and we made such a good case that they went and advocated for us with their own team. At the time they came back, we did our best to ensure that we met those promises that we said we were going to do. But if we had never asked, we would never have gotten the opportunity. So even if we don't get exactly what we're looking for, we're not afraid to ask for the next best thing. And then the final part of it was, I feel like I've shared. I feel like I've shared a lot. But another thing that I think that we did and we did really well was documenting. So we had a lot of reporting, like data-wise, story-wise. We always ensured that every progress that we made, to be able to ensure that the progress was repeatable success or something, we would document, we would put data together and say, this is what went well, this is what did not go well. These are the number of people that we trained this month. These are the number of people that we trained this year. These are the number of people that completed. These were the number of people that did not complete. And we would do all that. Every time we did a partnership with a partner, we did a partnership rather, we would always give those, or we would mostly give those partners, depends on the intensity of that partnership, reports as well. And what that did was that it strengthened trust. Beyond strengthening trust, it also helped people see, okay, this was where we needed help and this was where we were thriving. And that was just such a great telltale for us. A lot of people would recommend us and ask people to help us just because of our unconventional approach and our data and our ability to tell stories as well. People always think that telling stories is just about using words, but you can tell stories with numbers. If you were here before and then now you are here, you can use the numbers to say, okay, like it was through numbers that we found out that, yes, we had at a time more male applications, we had more female completions, but we would never have known that if we never tried. Those kind of stories are powerful. Being able to also pick somebody and make an example of them to say, look at this person. This person was selling soap. Today, they enrolled for a program. And now, many months after, they now have a job. Instead of the 20,000 naira they were earning per month selling soap, they now have a job where they're earning 250,000 naira per month. And those are very strong things and really powerful opportunities that I think that we were able to leverage on to be able to help us get ahead.
I have been opportune to interact with some of your team members. And one thing I noticed was that they share the same values as you do. And if you have conversations, I'm sure in your you've worked with different people, so you know the challenge people have with hiring and, you know, personnel. Can you tell me some of the strategies? I'm still using that same word, right? How did you manage your team? How did you ensure that everyone was aligned? Did you hire only those who had the vision and mission stuck in their head, or is it something that was cultivated over time?
I think it was both. One of the things that was really interesting during our hiring process, and this is a question I like to ask, I would ask you, what are your personal goals, right? If we know what your personal goals are, it's easier for us to see how, as a company, we can fit into those goals. You get what I mean? So, for example, we mostly would prefer to hire some, like, if we had two people who were equally skilled, we would pick the person who had a passion and a genuine care for people. Because in the nonprofit state, when you don't give people the opportunities that they want, they will throw tantrums, they will be angry, they will insult you, they will curse you. There's so many things that they will do that will not be to your benefit, right?
Uh-huh.
It takes a level of patience, care, and genuine concern for you to be able to look at, like, to be able to come back and respond with love. So one of the rules that we have in our organization is we will never insult or speak to anyone in a downgrading manner, irrespective of how disrespectful they are, right? So even when you insult someone and disrespect them, somebody would respond to you in a caring and genuinely loving manner. You understand where you're coming from. You know you didn't mean this like this. And that's what we would prefer. So if you probably have a hot temper, you probably don't get a job. Aggressive for good, right? So genuine care and passion would trump a lot of things. And then, of course, the skill. But you can train skill, you can train character, you can train culture fit. So those things are very important in making decisions. And when people see that their goals align with yours, they're more likely to give you their best. And because it also benefits them as well.
I've had this conversation time and time again. It is a matter of debate at this point about talent versus character. And people say if they have the talent, if they are good, what does it care if they have bad character? And you have already answered it, actually.
I mean, I also should also put the caveat, right, that it depends on what kind of business you're building, if it's front-facing or not. It depends on what kind of company you're building as well. It also depends on what the context is, because at different levels and stages in your business, you might need different things. There are some people who might have the talent and you just need them for a short period of time to build the foundations or to build the basics or something. Let them just come and go, right?
Yeah.
But then for longer terms, you want people who are shaping culture, because it takes one bad apple to scatter everything that you build and worked so hard for. So you don't want to, like I always say, be slow to hire, but quick to fire. If their bad character is seeping and spoiling the team's energy or the team's dynamic, if somebody is an individual star player, but then they don't know how to fit into a team and help the whole team shine in a way that is trumping the confidence or the growth of the overall company, the short burst of growth might look good, but it might destroy the company in the long term as well. So you want someone who is more of a team player. You want gradual but sustainable growth, as opposed to inexplicable speedy growth that you cannot maintain. It's more important to build or grow in a way that you can maintain than to grow, you know, all of a sudden and then you fall down as well, just as quickly as you grow. I prefer steady growth, and I would always favor steady growth that is consistent and replicable over overnight success that is not sustainable and is just, you know, like a stroke of luck.
Have you ever had someone tell you sincerely from the point of, oh, I want to learn, and not from the point of, I don't know and I don't care? Have you ever had anyone tell you that they did not have personal goals? They don't know what their personal goals are. They're just trying to figure it out. Have you ever had someone tell you that during an interview?
Yes. So we've had interns. So we've never had like a level person say that ever. But there, of course, when you're in a world where you hire interns, there's some interns who don't know what their personal goals are, but they know why they're coming here. They know why they're applying for this particular role. They know what they want to learn in the short term or how this would add value to their lives. So you might have scenarios like that. But even in scenarios where people don't, like if they say, this, I don't know what my goal is, they would give you an indication of what that goal is. It's also your responsibility to ask clarifying questions and say, okay, what about this? How do you feel about this? What are your interests? What, like, you might not know where you're going with your life, but the fact that you're willing to show up and do something, and that is itself, that in itself is an indicator, and it's a good indicator. I would always prioritize people who do over people who are just sitting down and dreaming and not doing anything about it. And that's something I write a lot about in my LinkedIn newsletters. My newsletters on LinkedIn. Always, and Substack as well. I always say that you can, it's easy for people to say, oh, this is what I want to do, and feel a quick level of dopamine because they said, I want to do this. And they keep talking about what they want to do. But then it takes a lot of guts for you to say, oh, I want to do this, but this is what I'm going to do for now. Or this is how I'm going to start. Somebody who is putting one foot forward in front of the other every single day is more likely to make success and create more opportunities for luck than somebody who is just sitting in their house dreaming and doing nothing about it. So if we find people who are more willing to do, people who value progress over perfection in the, you know, overly perfect sense of the word, we would very much favor that. But it's always good when you have a good combination of the dream and the do.
Fantastic. I was having a conversation with someone today. I was talking about your LinkedIn newsletters. I had to go get them from my email because I received them. And it's fantastic. Honestly. So let's talk about your, you know, what you've learned so far. Like looking back at your career, what is that thing that you're most proud of achieving?
Okay. For achievements, I would say the one thing that I'm proud of in general is every single person that I have been able to be a catalyst to help transform their lives in one way or the other. Anybody who has encountered me, my work or a product or a write-up or something that I did or said that completely changed, not even completely, but in some way changed the trajectory of the world. That's something you cannot buy in the market. That's something you can put a value on, a price on. It's just such a priceless feeling, because if you felt like your world was ending or you didn't know how to move on from here, or you felt stuck, and then just one little thing shifted everything for you. I think that's also, there's so many people who their lives have changed drastically, people who dream different, who talk different, who work different, just because they use the product that I built, or they were part of Aggressive for Good, or they listened to something that I said, or they took an opportunity that I shared. And so that's really, I think, the most impressive thing that I would ever say that I've achieved, just being an impact in people's lives.
Oh, okay.
But you asked what I've learned as well.
Yeah.
One thing I've learned is that there would always be something you don't have, but it's really important to use what you have to get you to where you think you want to be. So instead of focusing on the things that you don't have, ask yourself, what is it that I have? Now, can I use this to my advantage?
A lot of Nigerians know that, but they always attribute that saying for something different. Use what you have to get what you want.
You know, I wish we would use it more positively. But truly, truly, it works. If you really think about, like, imagine as a content creator, you can easily be like, oh, I don't have a computer. I don't have a camera, I don't have this, I don't have that. But what about the things that you have? Do you have a neighbor that has a phone that you can borrow, that you can go to their house and, you know, just use their phone to shoot the things that you want to shoot? If you cannot shoot videos, can you do audio? Can you write? What can you start with? You know, I when I say these things, I think about people like Emanuela, who started literally the whole MacAngel comedy,
you know,
thing that started, and you see where they started from. You watch those videos from many years ago and you watch the videos now and you can see the difference. And if they never started, they would never have gotten to this point that they're in. Imagine they did not start because they were looking for big cameras. You know, how long would it have taken to build that momentum? They probably wouldn't even have the kind of opportunity that people would have created for them by just saying, because these people are showing up with what they have, I want to support. There are people who were part of Aggressive for Goods program. They didn't have a laptop starting out. They probably used their phones to figure out how they could learn data skills. They used other devices, borrowed laptops from their friends, begged somebody to do this, you know, went to cyber cafes to try and figure out one or two things. And just because they were able to make those particular changes, it made a big difference in their life.
Okay, that's strong advice. And anytime, you know, you have conversation with founders, some people will tell you, I've had, you know, some ups and some downs, but the downs are not that much. And I really do not buy it. I feel like for every win, there are also challenges. Can you highlight the biggest challenge you've faced so far as an entrepreneur?
Oh, yeah, we faced so many challenges. So many challenges. One of them was definitely money. It was really difficult to be raising money during COVID lockdown. Most people were giving their money to relief packet, like relief systems, health, and all of that. But we were nonprofit, and at that time, people were not giving money. But we found a way. We spoke. We created a pilot program. There were so many things we did then, all of the founders together. I mean, made the people, the donors, feel like this was a worthy cause. And we showed proof that it was a worthy cause. We gave examples. We shared the work. As I said, we shared data. We showed proof of people's lives being transformed and all of that. And people bought into that. There were also times that we had to come up with other things to help us make, not make the money, but find other ways to make it possible for people who wanted to support us but didn't have large sums to still support us. So that was definitely a challenge that we were able to sort of begin.
Okay.
That would be one very big one, because money is not easy.
It's not easy for people to part with their money in any situation. It's not easy. So that's a good one. So for aspiring founders who are listening, who are going to listen to you, who are listening right now, who are just starting the entrepreneurial journeys, can you say something to them?
Well, I think that there are many things I could possibly say. But one of the things I know that is important is that consistency pays off. You should also say, this is going to come off a bit controversial, but it's okay to quit things. You don't have to do the same thing over and over again. If you've tried and you've applied pressure, and you feel like you no longer have the strength or will to pursue, interrogate your feelings. Ask yourself, am I tired? Or is this thing truly not working? Or am I not the right person to keep pushing this forward? Or do I need extra help to get this to another level? Or does someone else need to be the one pushing this? You don't have to be, as a founder, you don't also have to be the face of the business. You don't have to be the CEO, the everything. Be open and asking for help. Be humble enough to know when it's time to let go. But also be dogged enough to know that you can apply as much pressure. Like, you've done everything within your power first before you say, okay, it's time for me to let this thing go. I say that with all sense of like understanding that you wouldn't always know, but there are times that you could have enough telling examples. So, for example, if you run out of money, yeah, there are many scenarios in which you would be faced with the left or right and deciding, you know, is it time for me to let this go? I think I recently wrote about this in my Unbranded Letters, and I talked about how there was a game I newly started to play, and it has a journal feature. So every time I attack the monsters in the game, the journal will tell me, yes, I've been defeated. And that the journal will also tell me how much damage I did to the monster. And so that gives me it gives me some hope to tell me that, okay, if I did this much damage with this many troops or with this type of effort, then if I double this effort, I can do even more damage. Or if I go again, I can completely destroy this monster. Why am I giving this very unrelated example? Because sometimes when you're hitting a particular stone or you're hitting something, right, the effect of what you're doing might not be immediately visible to you, but it doesn't mean that you're not having an effect. So don't give up just because it's not visibly working. Interrogate and see, is this really failure? Are there other ways that, and for me, I also think maybe the way that I define failure is important, because I always talk about how life is an experiment. Nobody knows anything for sure. And if the way we're taught in science classes that the goal of an experiment you know, then it's true that the goal of an experiment is not to be right, but to discover. So it means that what we would see as failure is not necessarily that we fail to do it or something. It's just to gather data and gather information. So please, founders, whenever you have, maybe you experience rejection, pick the learnings out of it. Don't take it as failure. Look at it from a different perspective. And at the moment where you say, okay, it's time to let it go, interrogate your feelings. And if you say, no, it's not time to let it go, put in your best, build momentum, keep hitting the nail on that particular spot, it might actually finally get in. And it might even get in ways that you do not expect. As a founder, right? There's so much responsibility on you. Find time to also enjoy life, enjoy experiences, and build things that will last the test of time and outlive you as well. I'm looking forward to a Nigeria and Africa where we don't just build short-term businesses to, you know, satisfy our stomachs for the now, but we build things that have long-term impact, not just in our country, not just in our state, but in the whole continent at large. So every founder that is doing the great work of being a founder, I celebrate you for saying that you have the capacity to just really thrill.
That was beautiful. And you just mentioned something that you talked about where we had a conversation with you at Moonshot about work-life balance. That was a very interesting take. So no matter what you're doing, no matter the hustles you're and the not time and the effort you're putting in, find time to relax. So
please.
Okay. Finally, you know that the African startup ecosystem is booming. It's actually thriving. And of course, there are some downs, but the ups are looking good. What are some exciting trends that you hope to see in the coming years?
In the coming year, the one trend that I'm looking forward to is for white founders to empower more founders. That means if you've successfully raised money internationally, your business is thriving, and you are now a founder that has personal money as well, don't just spend your money acquiring, you know, physical assets, traveling. Dude, I mean, I can't tell you what to do with your money, but I think it would be really helpful to also become an angel investor, reinvest in the ecosystem, find ways to help improve the ecosystem so that we don't just grow in one way, right? We grow as a collective. If the collective thrives, there are more opportunities that open up. We need economic power as Africans, and that economic power is not just going to come from consistently depending on the West or the North or the East or the South or whoever to give you money. You have to build that capital to become self-sufficient. And so with the little seeds that have been planted, when we reap the fruits, let's not eat everything. Let's be conscious enough to take some of those seeds and replant them so that we can end up with a forest and not just one tree that everybody eats fruits from.
Hmm. You need to write a book if you have not done that already.
I'm ready now. I'm due.
You are, because the content of your brain is fascinating. That's why I had to have you on the show. Thank you very much. All right, and there we have it. We've had a conversation with the Blessing Abeng. I don't know if there's anyone in this industry that does not know you. If they don't know you, they don't know what you're doing, actually. And yes, thank you very much for joining us once more. This is Africa Tech Radio. My name is Lillian. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. That was such a great interview.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to catch up on all the live shows right here on AfricaTechRadio.com.